Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Peter Kornbluh, co-author of the book Back Channel to Cuba, who talks about the significance of President Obama's move to normalize U.S.-Cuba relations and the challenges ahead for both Washington and Havana. Sandra Steingraber, a biologist and anti-fracking organizer, who reflects on New York Governor Andrew Cuomo's decision to ban natural gas fracking, the first state in the nation to do so. And Paul Engler of the Center for the Working Poor in Los Angeles, who discusses the current nationwide mobilization against police violence in communities of color and the elements that contribute to the success of movements for social change. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
The rape of a young woman in New Delhi by a cab driver in early December raised new questions about why violence against women is so prevalent in India, even as new anti-rape laws came into force, as well as increased civil society activism confronting sexual assault and human trafficking. According to the Guardian newspaper, an average of 92 women are raped in India every day, with the number of reported sexual assaults rising to nearly 34,000 in 2013. A new study by the U.S.-based International Center for Research on Women found that more than 50% of Indian women surveyed had experienced violence during their lifetimes, while more than 60% of male respondents said they had acted violently against their wives or partners. The study released in New Delhi in November found that the average Indian man is, quote, convinced masculinity is about acting tough, freely exercising his privilege to lay down the rules in his personal relationships, and above all, controlling women, end quote. Civil society activist Anita Katyar observed, physical violence is not the only form of violence women in India face. In rural areas, especially those who belong to the Dalit community, are often denied land rights, education and health care, and their children, especially girls, bear the brunt of discrimination. Today, half of the 1.6 million Americans incarcerated in the nation's prisons work a full-time job, mostly doing menial institutional maintenance jobs like mopping floors, serving food, and cutting the grass. Since prison inmates are not considered employees, they are not eligible for disability pay, workers' compensation, Social Security withholding, or overtime pay. In three states, Texas, Georgia, and Arkansas, inmates receive no pay, not even a token wage, reviving the ugly history of prison chain gangs. Journalist Douglas Blackman told the American Prospect magazine that the current system can be traced back to convict leasing, which he calls slavery by another name. From the 1870s to the 1950s, prison inmates, mostly black, were routinely leased to private companies to work on plantations and in coal mines. During that era, inmates were forced to do the bidding of white masters through the regular application of extraordinary physical coercion. Today, most inmates provide cheap labor to prison operations. For example, a private sector dishwasher in Massachusetts earns over $9 an hour. That's over 30 times more than what an inmate makes for the same job. The solution to this grossly exploitative scenario would be to bring prison jobs under the Federal Labor Standards Act, which sets minimum standards for wages and working conditions. But Alex Friedman, managing editor of Prison Legal News, asserts, quote, if our criminal justice system had to pay a fair wage for labor that inmates provide, it would collapse, which in part explains why few politicians and no legislatures or courts show any inclination to make the much-needed reforms. With its sprawling 139-mile urban landscape, Detroit, the nation's former automobile manufacturing capital, is increasingly two distinct cities, racially divided and unequal, an echo of the warnings that came out of the 1968 Kerner Commission report on urban violence. Today, downtown Detroit is booming, driven in part by Dan Gilbert, the billionaire founder of Quicken Loans, who moved thousands of his employees to the city center from Michigan suburbs. At times, downtown Detroit looks like a fortress with layers of private security and hundreds of closed-circuit cameras. Meanwhile, 27,000 poor Detroit residents have had their water service cut off while facing growing economic hardship. Peter Hammer, a professor of law at Wayne State University, says post-bankruptcy Detroit has become a self-defined second-class city with some police and fire services and a bulldozer department to raise abandoned houses. Retired city employee Cheryl Labash now fears the loss of democratic rights in the new Detroit. Private security guards have stopped community activists from passing out flyers in an upscale area of the city that included a partially privatized public park. Labash now sees privately run development zones as a new method to deny free speech to the majority of Detroit's African American population. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Richard Hill.
In a dramatic announcement made from the White House on December 17th, President Obama announced his administration's decision to restore full diplomatic relations with Cuba's communist government. The shift in U.S. policy will include the exchange of ambassadors and the opening of a U.S. embassy in Havana for the first time in more than 50 years. In his announcement, the president said, quote, "Today America chooses to cut loose the shackles of the past so as to reach for a better future for the Cuban people, for the American people, for our entire hemisphere, and for the world." The historic breakthrough, negotiated with the help of Pope Francis over the past 18 months, involved the simultaneous release of prisoners. Cuba freed Alan Gross, an American government contractor arrested in 2009 and sentenced to 15 years in prison for trying to deliver satellite telephone equipment capable of cloaking connections to the Internet. Havana also released an unidentified U.S. spy who has been imprisoned in Cuba for 20 years and pledged to release 53 Cubans Washington asserts are political prisoners. Washington reciprocated by freeing three of the remaining Cuban intelligence agents known as the Cuban Five, who were convicted in 2001 of spying on U.S.-based anti-Castro exile leaders. Most but not all of the nation's Republican politicians openly opposed the administration's opening to Cuba. While Cuban-American U.S. Senator Marco Rubio of Florida denounced the normalization of relations with Havana, Libertarian GOP Senator Rand Paul of Kentucky publicly supported the move. President Obama can ease restrictions on banking, investment, and travel in Cuba, but only Congress can end the 54-year-old economic embargo against the island nation. Your reporter spoke with Peter Kornbluh, director of the Cuba Documentation Project at the National Security Archive, and co-author along with William Leo Grand of the book Back Channel to Cuba. Here, Kornbluh discusses the significance of the change in U.S.-Cuba relations and the challenges ahead for both Washington and Havana.
After 55 years of perpetual hostility in U.S. policy towards Cuba, a president, you know, I think, what, the 11th president since the Cuban Revolution, has finally gotten the nerve, the courage, and, you know, basically the political circumstance to make an extremely bold and comprehensive move to bury the past, a past that involves CIA paramilitary invasions at the Bay of Pigs, covert assassination plots, Operation Mongoose, regime change programs being run through USAID, a trade embargo intended to, you know, destabilize and destroy the Cuban economy, et cetera, et cetera. Bury that past and put some closure on this sinister history and move towards, you know, a much brighter future in which the United States doesn't try to push Cuba away, isolate Cuba, but actually engages Cuba in a normal relationship in which the United States obviously pursues the same interests that it had before, development, democracy, et cetera, but under a normal framework.
Peter, what are the challenges ahead? The Republicans, for the most part, with some exceptions, opposed the normalization of relations and vow to stop any kind of break in the embargo. What is it that Congress can do to throw a monkey wrench in the process of normalization here?
Well, I don't want to overstate how the Republican opposition. There's one very vocal Republican senator, Marco Rubio of Florida, who clearly wants to run for president. He has a vested interest in catering to the hardline Cuban American community, but you know they're not going to be votes there for him for that, because the votes are in the other direction in Florida now. And then there's the congresswoman from Florida, Ileana Ross Lehtinen, and there are others, and there'll be more when the Republicans take over the Senate and the House in a big way in January. And sure, there's a lot of talk about trying to roll back Obama's initiatives on Cuba through legislation. Now, that could be a long, drawn-out process. If Obama's still president, he can veto these bills. It could get very complicated. But, you know, I think there's going to be a momentum, and I think that the business community will begin to be involved to, and hopefully to a point where they kind of get a foothold in Cuba, and then they start pushing, you know, these legislators to go ahead and let this thing go, you know, kind of like Obamacare. You know, once 10 million people signed up, it was kind of hard to roll back. And you know, once there is it clear that if there's going to be creation of jobs in the port of New Orleans and the port of Tampa, and there's going to be cruise lines going to Cuba and investment in commerce and things that bring people into the fold, there may be political allies that we don't have right now that will step up and help not only keep these changes in place but advance them further.
In short, do you think the Cuban Revolution, David, if you will, overcame all the odds to defeat the United States Goliath in this 50-year conflict?
As Raul Castro just said this last, I think on Saturday, to the Parliament, we won the war. And he's saying that because there is a degree of validation for the Cuban Revolution in arriving at an agreement where they are recognized and accepted by a U.S. president, by the U.S. government, by the Colossus of the North, by the imperial empire that has tried for all these years to roll back the revolution, kill, assassinate Fidel Castro, undermine the economy. And the Cubans are still there, while one president after another that authorized these operations are gone, and now the policy is gone. Now the policy is a policy of the past. And I think this is a degree of validation achievement for the Cuban Revolution. It's meaningless, however, unless the revolution means something to Cubans. It has a historical meaning now. It was an incredible act of courage and fortitude by a very small group challenging the United States and sustaining that challenge and surviving U.S. pressures and efforts to undermine and roll back the Cuban Revolution for all these decades. But now, really, something else is on the agenda. As one Cuban on the street said to me, you know, no se puede comer la política. You can't eat politics. And so economic success in the future is what's going to, you know, really be the legacy of the Cuban Revolution.
That was Peter Kornbluh, director of the Cuba Documentation Project at the National Security Archive, and co-author along with William Leo Grand of the new book Backchannel to Cuba. For more perspectives on the normalization of U.S.-Cuba relations, visit our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. On December 17th, New York Governor Andrew Cuomo's administration banned hydraulic horizontal fracturing for natural gas, or fracking, making it the first state in the country with major shale gas deposits to take this step. The anti-fracking decision was announced by New York State's acting health commissioner, Dr. Howard A. Zucker, who said a years-long study had found significant public health risks associated with fracking. Holding up copies of scientific papers to support the decision, Dr. Zucker listed concerns about water contamination and air pollution and said there was insufficient scientific evidence to suggest that fracking was safe. Sandra Steingraber is a biologist, writer, and one of the leaders of both statewide and local efforts to ban fracking. As part of the group We Are Seneca Lake, she's engaged in nonviolent civil disobedience and has been arrested with dozens of other activists in protest against the energy company Crestwood Midstream. Crestwood plans to store millions of barrels of liquid petroleum gases in salt caverns beneath Seneca Lake, the largest of the Finger Lakes in mid-state New York. Seneca is one of the deepest lakes in the world and the location of many wine vineyards and a magnet for tourism. Local activists fear that the proposed gas storage plan would devastate their rural economy. Between the Lines' Melinda Tu, who spoke with Steingraber about Governor Cuomo's decision to ban fracking and her group's ongoing campaign to stop the proposed gas storage project beneath Seneca Lake.
He did not ban fracking by executive order, so the environmental impact statement itself will reflect the new science in the Department of Health's Health Review, which is part of the draft generic supplemental environmental impact statement. So in its final form, that impact statement will call for the prohibition of fracking. And so to overturn that, one would have to start the environmental impact statement process all over again, which would require public hearings and all kinds of things. So this is an enduring ban on fracking in New York.
Your group, We Are Seneca Lake, is just one of many groups around the state that organized for a ban on fracking, and it seems to have worked.
There were several of us, Tony Ingrafia from Cornell, myself, several physicians, including Adam Law, who's an endocrinologist, who went around town to town for years, speaking in church basements, speaking in junior high school auditoriums and to Rotary clubs, debating the gas industry on the science. And in the early days, we only had a handful of studies. When we began this, there were only 6 studies in the peer-reviewed medical literature, in the scientific literature. Now there are 414 studies. And so it's like putting together a jigsaw puzzle. You know, when you have a few pieces, it's hard to see what the pattern is here. But as we began to fill the picture in, it became really clear that this is a menace to the climate. It's a menace to people's health. It's contaminating air and water in ways that cannot be fixed through any regulations, because obviously some parts of this infrastructure are unregulatable, if only because it's our geological bedrock. We can't control what happens when you blow it apart and inject it with lubricating toxic chemicals. Nature has its own way with things like that. As we got more and more damning evidence for risk and harm, we began to get this out to the public, not only in our PowerPoint presentations in church basements, but also, you know, I helped lead people to submit comments on the draft regulations by laying the science out to people, you know, on websites and then translating it into plain English and inviting people to send in comments. And so through that process, we submitted 204,000 comments on everything that was left out of the environmental impact statement. We basically buried it alive in public comments, and those were very well-informed, scientifically based comments. But because we knew that regulatory agencies are often captured by the industries that they attempt to regulate, we brought that science directly out to the citizenry so they could become really well-informed. This was a fight worth having. It was a fight for my children's future. It was a fight for the place where we live and for our air and our water. And I just had to fight with my whole heart. And I think when you do that, you can win. I think that's the message. We broke a spell here. You know, the spell was that oil and gas always gets what it wants. It's the biggest industry in the world. People can't fight the oil and gas industry. Well, we just did.
Sandra Steingraber, how does this ban on fracking relate to your struggle to keep fracked gas, including methane, propane, and butane, out of the salt caverns under Seneca Lake? I know that FERC, the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, already approved Crestwood's application.
The ban on fracking only applies to actually drilling and doing horizontal high-volume hydraulic fracturing, and that we won't do in New York. But in the meantime, of course, the gas industry is building out all the infrastructure for fracking, including pipelines and compressor stations and then storage depots. So Seneca Lake will become, if the gas industry has its way, with absent our intervention, a giant gas station. But because the federal government is in charge of much of that project, that approval has already happened. We tried mightily through all legal means to redress grievance. We brought good science to bear. We testified. We gave comments. We organized the public to send thousands of comments in opposition. And all that was simply ignored and swept aside by our Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, FERC, which is a rogue agency as far as I can see. It has no congressional oversight. There's no appeal process. So we are left now with a civil disobedience campaign. So we are speaking with our bodies at the gates. We began with a handful of us being arrested on the day that the approval was given to begin construction. A civil disobedience movement was born at the gates of Crestwood.
That was Sandra Steingraber, a biologist, writer, and organizer with the group We Are Seneca Lake. She serves as a scientific advisor to Americans Against Fracking. Learn more about local and national groups opposed to natural gas fracking by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. In a sustained eruption of activism not seen in America since the Occupy Wall Street movement blossomed in September 2011, anti-police violence activists continue to organize protests in hundreds of cities across the U.S. Participants in these street protests are a diverse group, comprised of old and young, urban and suburban, and black and white. Outrage at a grand jury decision not to indict a white police officer involved in the shooting death of Michael Brown, an unarmed African-American teenager in Ferguson, Missouri, and a similar decision in the case of the police chokehold death of Eric Garner, a 43-year-old unarmed black man in New York City, were the catalyst that launched coast-to-coast protests. The slogans of this new civil rights movement, Black Lives Matter, Hands Up Don't Shoot, and I Can't Breathe, were seen and heard when Reverend Al Sharpton of the National Action Network led a march of more than 10,000 in Washington, D.C. on December 13th. After the December 20th execution-style murder of two New York City police officers by a man who struggled with mental illness, some police officials and politicians attempted to link the protest movement to this terrible crime. But with the long history and emotional resonance of police violence in communities of color across the country, the overwhelmingly peaceful protests have continued undeterred. Protesters are making a number of similar demands that include strengthening of civilian complaint review boards, the use of body and dashboard cameras by police, special prosecutors to investigate police misconduct, and laws against racial profiling. But some activists say that the protests need to move beyond police brutality and focus on issues such as housing, unemployment, and improving inner-city schools. Your reporter spoke with Paul Engler, founding director of the Center for the Working Poor in Los Angeles, and co-author, with his brother Mark Engler, of the recent article, What Makes Nonviolent Movements Explode. Here he discusses the political climate, organizing strategies, and the power of disruption, all important elements in what makes some movements for social change succeed and others fail.
I think that actually organizing around police brutality, even in the Arab Spring, the first major actions in Egypt and in Tunisia was police brutality. And in the civil rights movement, some of the biggest actions that generated the most amount of publicity was when Bull Connor or police during the Selma March beat up protesters. And I think like Mike Brown and Eric Garner and the indictments all create this place where it's creating a crisis. And it's getting to a place where there's so much polarization that there is a lot of bottom-up spontaneous activity. I think the challenge for organizations is really trying to create training so that a lot of that bottom-up activity can, in some ways, it can be an upgrade. There can be a fast learning curve for all this amazing leadership that's coming from the grassroots. But that leadership needs, in some ways, support. It needs education to know how to vary the tactics, how to build organization, how to do a lot of these things. And in many countries where popular movements are able to survive, they do a process of mass training. Or during the student sit-ins in the 1960s, where there was massive amounts of students getting arrested in sit-ins to desegregate lunch counters, there was this huge organization that was formed, SNCC, that was basically a coalition of all the different little groups, and then they did massive amounts of nonviolence trainings and educating the bottom-up activists and leaders into higher and higher levels of sophistication in their organizing. And there is some people out there that are good at what they do in organizing, but that knowledge needs to be democratized. It needs to be spread very quickly. Just as the activity is spreading virally, there needs to be another mechanism that spreads virally to support activists for learning the crucial skills of organizing so that they can go through another cycle of momentum.
Well, Paul, in my discussions with people who are leading this new movement opposing police violence in communities of color, we've discussed the issue of
the overlap of economic issues, the shrinking of the middle class, the death of the American dream for many, and the issue of police violence, and how they all lead to similar changes required in the system here in the United States. Do you foresee that we will have a symbiosis of this anti-police violence movement with a movement that takes in a larger number of issues, particularly economic issues?
Well, there's no doubt. I think when something becomes really hot and galvanizes a huge portion of the public, when I say a huge portion, I'm just saying 1-2% of the population, that's millions and millions of people out on the street. It's just 1-2% of the population. Those people, if you're in the activist culture in a city, you'll realize that a lot of those people are going to be educated, and that's the popular movement is sort of the ladder, is the first rung on a ladder, or it's a funnel at which people become politicized, they become radicalized, and they become interested in a wide variety of issues. And really, these issues are about power. They're about the fact that there is a power inequality, both economic and political, that means that people don't have a say, that they can have these policies that basically encourage a culture of police brutality without accountability, and there's no democratic check on that. And I think that is the core of economic issues. That's the core of so many issues in the United States of America. And I see it among my friends. I mean, that we do momentum trainings, talking about how to create momentum and how to organize this stuff. And so many of the people that are interested in police brutality issues are also interested in economic inequality issues. There is a cross-fertilization, and a lot of times they're the same people leading those movements. There's so much crossover. In my personal experience, I see that. And also, I think the more you create a base of people that are energized, activated, willing to get arrested, willing to protest, those people will do that around any issue that they're activated around. So I think that there is a crossover. There is a possibility. Once you hit a critical mass of people that are willing to do things, then it's easier to cross-fertilize many movements. And that's what you saw at the end of the 1960s and early 70s, is that the civil rights movement really gave birth to a lot of other movements. And I think we're seeing that now. I think like a lot of those movements are cross-fertilizing each other and are creating new opportunities for movements to explode.
That was Paul Engler, founding director of the Center for the Working Poor in Los Angeles. Find links to the article he co-wrote with his brother Mark, titled What Makes Nonviolent Movements Explode, and related news and commentary on our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines through our website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archive programs in MP3 and streaming audio. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Twitter at BTL Radio News. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Richard Hill, Hank Hoffman, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Gary Trujillo, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.